Well, good morning again. Morning. My name is Erin Fitzgerald, and I am one of the pastors on staff here at St. Paul's United Methodist Church. It's my privilege to be with you at the open door today and most Sundays, unless I'm called to be elsewhere. And today we are going to continue our sermon series called This Is Us, where we are exploring the book of Ruth in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures, and we're on the fourth of four Sundays in that series, and the fourth of four chapters in the book of Ruth. It's just a little teeny tiny book in your Bible in the Old Testament. And today, what's going to unfold before us is a wedding scene, if you can believe it, okay? It's not going to look like a bride walking up the center aisle to meet her groom and a congregation of people who have gathered to witness the ceremony in all of its beauty and brilliance, and after spending thousands of dollars and then go out afterwards to have a big meal and a nice party. It's not going to look quite like that. But I want you to listen to these words from Ruth chapter 4 and watch as love comes into the picture. No sooner had Boaz gone up to the gate and sat down there than the next of kin, of whom Boaz had spoken, came passing by. So Boaz said, "Come over here, friend, and sit down. Sit down here." And he went over and sat down. And then Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the next of kin, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our kinsman, Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me so that I may know, for there is no one prior to you to redeem it, and I will come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. A few verses later, the story continues, and Boaz says to the men gathered, I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabite, the wife of Mahlon, to be my wife, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance, in order that the name of the dead may not be cut off from his kindred and from the gate of this native place. Today, you are witnesses. Huh. Happy wedding day. I skipped a few verses in there. We skipped from verse 4 to 10. And the part that I skipped is the confusing part that I don't fully understand. And so that's in part why we skipped it. But what happens in those verses is that Boaz takes off one of his sandals and he gives it to another man in the circle that's gathered there to say, okay, just like I owned this sandal, now I own the piece of land and I own Ruth the Moabite as my wife. And as I was reading that story, I was saying, wait a minute, that's not right. Does that mean that Ruth the Moabite is only as valuable as his right shoe? Does that mean that women can be property, just like clothes and footwear can be property? I don't know if I like that. I like most of the other things that Boaz has done in this story, by showing charity and grace to a woman who was in need, by offering her to come and glean in his wheat fields. I liked that. I liked the ways that Boaz stood up for Ruth as a woman and how he told his men and his other slaves not to bother her, not to get in her way, but to actually be more gracious and more generous to her and give her extra wheat from the bundles they had already tied up together, because she was hungry and she really needed that food. I liked it when Boaz said to Ruth, if you get thirsty after working out in the hot sun all day, go ahead and drink the water from my wells. I want you to be healthy. I want to be able to quench your thirst. And even in this scene, there's parts of this that I like. Boaz is standing up for Ruth as a widow, as a woman in distress, and for her sister Naomi. He's acting as an engaged participant in a relationship, as someone who loves her as one of God's beloved and wants to do what's best for her. And so in their context, in their society, that meant taking her as his wife. But the story's complicated, right? There's a little gray matter in there where it's not perfect. We see the do's, we see the don'ts, we see the yes, we see the no, but we also see the gray matter where it's like, I don't know if I want to call Ruth a piece of property. I don't know if I want women in this story to be owned, to be enslaved, to be oppressed in that way. I don't like that part of the story. When I think about us in our daily life, in our daily context, I think about all the ways in which we go through life and we notice things that seem a little off-putting, where we go, I don't know if I like that. That doesn't seem fair. That doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem just. That doesn't seem holy or God-like or like what I understand to be something good. There are all kinds of situations going on in life right now that we could name. There are racial tensions. There are income disparities between men and women. There are laws being written about what can happen to women's bodies. There are kids who are being educated, but the education looks different here than it does 60 miles away. There are all kinds of things that cause us to pause and say, I don't know if that's right. I don't know if that feels good. I don't know if that is what God intends for these people in this situation. And so we have to pause and we have to think about how do we as people of faith read a story and how do we respond to that story? My husband is a great driver. In fact, he's the primary driver in our family if we're going to go someplace, whether it's out to eat or whether it's across the state to see family or if it's just a little errand in town. He's usually the one to drive. And my husband, I believe, up until about 3 years ago, suffered from road rage. In most areas of his life, he's a pacifist. But when he gets on the road, and if something that doesn't feel right, that doesn't feel fair, happens to him in traffic, he gets really upset. He would use all 10 digits to express himself. He would raise his voice and sometimes roll down the window. He's very liberal with the use of the horn. And sometimes he would even probably disobey laws himself in order to demonstrate the right way to do something. When I was pregnant with our son Michael, who's now 3, Joel and I had a very serious conversation, one of the biggest fights we ever got in our marriage, when I had to confront this issue of road rage and say, now when you've got a baby in the back seat, I need you to behave a little differently. Because while I trust you and your behavior, I'm not sure that I trust the other drivers on the road not to retaliate against you and your road rage. And so as the conversation unfolded, we started talking, and he heard my concerns, and I heard his concerns, and the language changed for Joel to road rage to road justice. But now he doesn't have road rage, he has road justice. And what he does is he really demonstrates a lot of self-control in those situations. And rather than making his old behaviors manifest again, what he does now is he keeps his hands on the wheel at 10 and 2 and he tightens the grip so that his knuckles get white like he was driving in a snowstorm, but he's actually just mad. And he speaks out loud what should have happened in that situation, but what doesn't. And then he says, "Oh, God bless that driver. They just sped around me and then turned right and hit the brakes real hard and didn't use their turn signal. God bless them." This is a silly story, but you get the idea of when we see something that is not right, we are called upon to, as Christian people, to act upon it. And in our context, acting upon it, responding, and seeking a way of justice and righteousness looks a little different from time to time and from place to place and situation to situation. So while I may not understand or agree with why Boaz took Ruth as his wife and had to treat that woman as a piece of property to be owned, to be inherited, to be bought, I understand why he did it the way he did it because of his context. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So in our life, as people who are followers of Jesus Christ and as people who are part of the United Methodist Church, we are also called in our context to seek justice, to make things right when we see a wrong. And I want to read to you something that was written by United Methodists in the Book of Social Principles, which you'll have an opportunity in just a few minutes to come and pick up. It says, the question is, why do we participate in justice as United Methodists? And here's the answer. The United Methodist Church believes God's love for the whole world is an active and engaged love, a love seeking justice and liberty. We cannot just be observers. So we care enough about people's lives to risk interpreting God's love, to take a stand, to call each one of us into a response, no matter how controversial or complex it requires. The church helps us think and act out of a faith perspective, not just responding to all the mind makers up that exist in our society, but doing the right thing at the right time so that other people can experience God's love. So the story of God's people, of Boaz and Ruth and Naomi, and of people just like you and me, is a story of God setting things right with an active and an engaged love. We see that played out most intimately through the story of Jesus Christ in the New Testament, for whom God so loved the world, God sent God's only Son to be active, to be engaged, to be with us, to walk with us and talk with us, to teach us, to die and to rise for us. In other places in the story of the Bible, in the story of our faith, God sent prophets, people who understood God's promises and God's laws and God's desires for humanity and could interpret that for other people, loud and with a microphone, just like the one I'm using today. God sends all kinds of people into the world to make the world more just, more equitable, more peaceful, more loving. I want to tell you a story about a man named Brian Stevenson, who is a lawyer who went to Harvard Law School. But before he got there, his life's journey had been long and winding. He grew up in the South. His grandfather had been a man who owned slaves. His grandfather and father had been men who didn't know how to love in the context of their marriage. And so domestic violence was real in their family life and situation. And Brian grew up in this setting where he could look at the history and look at the context and look at the people around him he knew, and he could say, that isn't right. That is not the way things are supposed to be. That violence, that harm, that oppression, that is not who we are called to be as a family and as people of faith. And so Brian grew up with this really strong orientation and sense of justice that was right there in his belly, right there in his gut. He just could sense right from wrong. And so he grew up and he became educated and he wanted to become a lawyer. So he went to Harvard Law School. And after he graduated and he passed the bar exam, Brian Stevenson went on to become a lawyer who defended people who were wrongly convicted of crimes, specifically inmates on death row. He went on to defend inmates on death row who were believed to be innocent until proven guilty. But the science hadn't caught up yet, and their cases need to be tried again. And their stories needed to be retold so that everybody who thought that is not right could have a second chance to interpret the story, to listen to the facts, to understand what really went on. One of the inmates that Brian Stevenson cared for in his work as a lawyer was a young man who, at a very young age, was convicted of a very violent crime. There was a question about whether the crime was in self-defense or whether it was premeditated. And Brian's job at the end of the trial was to prove that this young man was innocent because his life was in danger and he was protecting his younger siblings and acting out of self-defense. And that's why the violent crime happened. The mother of this young man was sitting in the courtroom throughout all of the trial proceedings, and she had waited years upon years upon years for her son to be released from prison and to be found innocent rather than guilty. Bless you. And at the end of the trial, the young man was released. He was given liberty and freedom and his life back. He was given a second chance. And his mother went up to the lawyer, to Brian Stevenson, and she said to him, "You know what? There are some people in life who will always want to react, who will always want to throw stones, who will always want to pass judgment. But you, sir," she said to Brian, "you're not throwing the stones. You're catching them." As a lawyer, this young man, Brian Stevenson, had an opportunity to do good. He had an opportunity to right wrongs. He had an opportunity to offer people second chances. And so rather than being the one who was throwing stones, who was throwing judgments, who was continuing the oppression and the violence, he was the one who was catching them and putting them down. He was the one who was catching them and trying to right the wrongs. He was the one who was catching them and trying to tell the story in a different light. Each one of us, as United Methodists and as people who follow Jesus Christ, have an opportunity to be stone catchers in our daily life. When we see something that doesn't feel right or good or holy, we have a choice not to participate in that thing or that action or that language of speech, but rather to catch the stones and to try to do the right thing in our context, in that moment, to that one person. We have an opportunity, when we see something not going right, to catch the stone, to intervene, and to offer grace and love, to be active and engaged in the love that Jesus Christ brought into this world, to catch and to put it away so that the story can be told in a different light. About a week ago, actually about 3 weeks ago. My husband and I were in rural Texas. We were driving from San Antonio to Dallas, and it turns out Texas is a pretty big state. And so that drive on the map didn't look too bad, but ended up being about 6.5 hours with traffic and a couple of stops. And so we were stopped at a gas station, and then we went inside to go potty and get a bite to eat and everything else. And it was a small diner type place, kind of a Greasy Spoon. It was a seat yourself organization. And so we sat ourselves down, and immediately we're served well. We got our drinks, we got our menus, we placed our order and everything else. But we noticed that the couple who came in before us weren't getting the same kind of service. And so one of the things we did before we placed our order for our meal was to say to our waitress, "Thank you so much for taking really good care of us, but we want you to know we weren't here first. The couple at the other booth walked in first, and they haven't gotten their menus or their drinks yet." And the waitress said, "Oh, okay." And she went and tried to justify the situation. And then she came back to us, took our order. We had placed our order, and the food came out quite quickly. Before the food came out for the other table where the other couple was seated, That didn't feel right. That didn't feel good. There was something right in the pit of my stomach that told me that's not holy. And so once more, we went to our waitress, who came by to refill our glasses of water a second time and to clear away the plates as we were finishing. And we said, "You know, did they order a steak dinner or something that takes a really long time to cook?" And she said, "No, I'll have to go check on that." And so she did, and she brought out the food. And the couple gently and quietly asked if she would take it back and reheat the food, because at this point it was cold. And she did, no questions asked. In that moment, as we were sitting and watching the whole scene unfold, we could tell that this couple was married. We could tell that they were traveling just like we were. They didn't have any children with them. They were prepared to pay for their meal. The only difference we could see was that we were white and they were African American. And as the situation unfolded, Joel and I kept talking through what happened and what was wrong with it, and was there anything we could do besides speaking up to our waitress and advocating on their behalf that the wrongs be righted. And finally, at the end of the meal, we talked to our waitress up at the counter near the cash register, rather quietly and privately. And we said, we don't feel like they got good service and that they got the nice meal that they were hoping for when they walked in this restaurant. And we're wondering if the manager is going to discount any part of their bill." And she said, "No, I don't think so." And then Joel and I said, "Well, then we'd like to pay for their meal. We'd like to offer that today." And she rang it all up, and she swiped our card and took care of it. And as we were leaving the restaurant, Joel and I were on vacation. We were trying to get on our way and get to Dallas to see our friends. We weren't in the spirit of being pastoral necessarily. So we weren't trying to make conversation that would convert or evangelize this couple in any way. But we stopped by and we said, "Have a blessed journey. We pray you reach your destination safely, and that the next place you go, you're treated with the respect that you deserve. They smiled, and we walked on our way and continued. I don't know in that moment if we did the right thing. I don't know if there was something better or bigger or more just that we could have done. I don't know if we did the thing that God would have wanted us to do, even. But in that moment, advocating and paying for someone else's meal felt like a way that we could be active and engaged in the love that we've experienced from Jesus Christ. It felt like the way that we could persist in our pursuit of justice and resist the injustice and oppression that we witnessed happening around us. It felt like one way we could be stone catchers, where we could right a wrong and change the story that that couple might tell about their experience in that diner. You all, as you go through your daily life, are going to have more instances, more experiences, more people whose story needs to be told in a different light, whose experience can be altered or changed based on your words, your actions, your witness. So, as the band plays our next song, I'm going to invite you as the congregation to come forward to this little table we have here. In this basket, there are stones, and on this table, there is a pamphlet. It's a simple river stone, and it's a short read, but it's the United Methodist Church's social principles. It's an example of how we are called to be people who live in active and engaged love, who right wrongs, who tell the truth, who see the gray areas in life, and want to know how we, as people of faith, believe and are called to act on those beliefs. If you've never read this, it's short and it's easy, and you might have questions afterwards. I welcome your questions. I welcome charitable conversation. So even if you disagree or aren't sure about everything in this book, know that you can come to me or any other pastor on our staff and talk about that. If you choose to take a rock today, I want to invite you to take a challenge with it. I want to challenge you to be stone catchers, to live an active and engaged love as a testimony of your faith and how you seek to live it out every day. We know that we're not going to get it right each and every day, and that's why there's God's grace. But we do know that there are times when we are not called to be silent, but when we are called to act, when we are called to stand up for people and the things we believe in. The greatest thing that we believe in is love. And so as you take this stone, know that you are taking up courage so that you can live that love out loud in the world every day. Will you pray with me? God, your grace is good. Your grace is with us today and every day as we seek to live your love, show the example of your son Jesus in the world, and work to make things right when they are not right. Help us to be bold and courageous, to stand up for you, for your love, and for all people, for equity and for human rights, for social justice, so that the kingdom that your son began on earth might be brought to completion, one person, one moment, one experience, one day at a time. Amen.